Hello, I'm Amanda D'Academy, and you're listening to The Conversation, a show where I talk to the people I find most inspiring about the issues and life experiences that really matter. This week on The Conversation, I'm speaking to Pulitzer Prize winning journalists Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey from The New York Times. Jodi and Megan broke one of the most impactful and influential stories of the last decade. They are responsible for exposing Harvey Weinstein for being the serial abuser that he is. And their reporting is largely what is responsible for exposing his behavior and ultimately ending in a jail sentence. So it is a real treat to speak to them. Jodi, I have known for quite a while. I had the pleasure of interacting with her early on in her investigation with Harvey Weinstein and got to see her work in action. It was the first time I was exposed to an investigative journalist and how they work. And I wanted to interview both of them because they have put out a really incredible book called Chasing the Truth, which is a young journalist's guide to investigative reporting. And given that it is so hard to actually find truthful journalism these days, and there are so many people who are posing as journalists and who are not as thorough and based in integrity as these two journalists are, I wanted to speak to them because they are real trailblazers, and it was a fascinating talk. I hope you enjoy them as much as I do. Jodi and Megan, thank you so much for taking time to come on The Conversation. And I just finished reading your new book. It was so nice to actually read something from cover to cover because normally I don't really have time to read it all. But I have to say that Chasing the Truth, what an awesome title, really kept me engaged from cover to cover. And I was curious why you chose to write this book at this point. Who wants to go first? How does this work with both of you? Because you must have such shorthand with each other. I don't know how you work out who
wants to. We normally just take turns. Do you want to start, Jodi?
Sure. So ever since we broke the Harvey Weinstein story, we felt so many things. We have felt the power of the Me Too movement. We have felt the power of our sources' stories. We have felt the force and confusion of living in social change. But one of the things we've really felt was overwhelming interest from young people, often young women, not only, but interest in all of these themes, in feminism, in the question of where change comes from, in confronting authority, asking the big questions about society, and tremendous interest in journalism. So what we did is we took our book, She Said, which is the kind of behind the scenes of the Harvey Weinstein investigation, and we re-engineered it so that you are on the detective story and you're there in the room as we're talking to sources for the first time, as we're confronting Weinstein. But the book is also intended to be a kind of manual for journalism, to bring it up close for readers, especially young readers. And we want them to feel a sense of invitation. We want them to feel like, look, this world that we live in the New York Times offices, where we do this kind of work all the time, it can be yours as well.
I'm so encouraged to hear that you've had such an incredible response from young women about journalism. Gives me hope, especially given how confused so many people are about what is the truth and how do I find the truth? And there's so much dishonest journalism and fake news out in the world. So I'm encouraged to hear that. I'm curious why both of you chose a career of journalism. What was the impetus for you, Megan?
So this is the first time that Jodi and I are also sharing our own personal stories, how we went from teenagers to investigative journalists at the New York Times, and not just how we did it, but why we did it. And from early ages, I think Jodi and I both had a desire to want to make a difference in the world. Like so many other young people, we looked around us and we saw injustice, and we wanted to help make the world a better place, as cheesy as that sounds. And when I was in high school, you know, I was feeling a pull towards more traditional activism. I was part of a walkout in my high school to protest racism by a particular teacher. And when I was in college, I helped organize a Take Back the Night rally to help draw attention to sexual assault on college campuses. And those things were really, like, really motivating and really exciting to be part of. And in participating in kind of some of this more traditional activism, you could feel like you were making a difference. But it was clear as I started getting into journalism, like working in journalism after college, and I worked at small newspapers, and I worked in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I worked in Moscow in Russia for an English language newspaper. I really worked all over the place. But once I started working in journalism and I started to see the impact that, you know, well-researched and well-reported stories could make, it was like I completely got hooked. And I could really see what tremendous change could come from especially investigative journalism. The Weinstein story for me and Jody came after years of doing other hard-hitting investigative reporting, whether it was Jody reporting on unfair conditions at Amazon or Starbucks. I did a lot of reporting on sex crimes and untested rape kits. And what was so galvanizing was to see that this work could bring about change, that bad guys could go to prison, that laws could change, that policies could change. And I think that what we wanted to do here was we wanted to show that this desire for it. But that said, Jody and I had never been, I think for all of the high impact work we had done previously, it wasn't until the Weinstein story, we never could have imagined being part of such a large, doing journalism that could help spur this like massive cultural shift. And so I think what we wanted to do was we wanted to like, and listen, there's so many different paths that people can take that can do and make a difference in this world. But we really wanted to take young readers behind the scenes and show them, really unpack how this particular profession works, the guidelines that we follow, the due diligence, the sort of precise gathering and reporting of facts, and even going to the subjects at the end of the day to make sure that they had the chance to respond, even in the case of Harvey Weinstein, when that means him barging into the New York Times uninvited with his lawyers and swinging back and forth between threats and sort of compliments. But we wanted to show that this work, in doing this work, you can confront bullies, you can hold power to account, and you can actually help bring about social change.
Well, you can, and you both have shown that with this story, with the Weinstein story in particular. But I think it's also because you had the weight of a credible publication behind you. Like I said, one of the biggest challenges today is for people to be able to trust the source. And in many ways, this book really educates young readers what is possible with an amazing team. Jody, I think maybe you told me this a long time ago, but how did you both come to work on the Weinstein story?
So first of all, I do want to say that you're right, that having the support of a powerful institution was very important. We also see student journalists doing really ambitious things. Boy, are they taking on issues in their own community and even sometimes the power structures in their own schools. And almost because they're doing it without a net and because they're doing it without the support that we have, we want to give them as much support from afar as possible. And also a sense of what's appropriate and what's not, because these tools are powerful and you don't want to use them the wrong way. You want to use them judiciously.
When you and I first spoke about, did I know any people who would be interested in going on record with you? Mm-hmm. I always remember you saying to me that it wasn't about your personal opinion. It wasn't about how you necessarily felt about it, an individual. It was about looking for patterns. And you gave me guidelines of what to look for when I was speaking to people. And you basically said, look, the sort of factual things you need to look for that really aren't to do with your opinion on whether you like that person or not. It's very clear kind of directions on how I would assess something as whether that could be a good person for you to speak to. Having integrity to start off with, that would be a quality I would think is necessary for being an investigative journalism. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And that's why the book is called Chasing the Truth. It's not called Chasing Harvey Weinstein. Amanda, you were one of several well-connected women in Hollywood who really helped us with the investigation. And I don't think this was you, but there was an almost comical instance in a text exchange I had with somebody else. This person was generously helping me get phone numbers, like private contact in for actresses. And she said something casually to me in the exchange, we're going to get that. And we're going to get that rapist or something. And at the time, he was not a convicted rapist, which he is now. And I remember, even though this was like somebody helping me and she was pretty powerful and stuff, I had to give her a little lecture, Amanda. And I had to say, we don't talk like that in investigative journalism. If anyone asks, just say, we are only after the truth. We are only after the truth, because that's your compass and that's what protects you. It protects you legally. And also it protects you from getting trapped, like, frankly, in other people's BS, because this isn't about political parties, right? Harvey Weinstein was a huge Democratic donor. He tried to help get Hillary Clinton, elected. He was very involved in liberal causes. This isn't about who you're friends with. This isn't about who you schmooze with. This is about the truth of what happened. And so if that is your guidance, it can be like a knife that cuts through all this other stuff and helps you stay true to who you are. And it protects all the parties involved. It protects the victims, because they're not out for personal vengeance. They're just out for the truth. It protects the journalists who can say the same thing. And it protects the accused, actually, because this isn't about targeting them as individuals for personal motives. It's about just finding out what really happened.
And yet there are so many people whose perception of the truth is distorted. I always felt like there was one truth. Certainly as someone who interviews people, I'm always after the truth of who they are as a human being. And then sometime over the last couple of years, I realized, oh, everybody has their truth. Everyone has their reality. The only way you can get to the absolute truth is by factual information. And without that factual information, it's just one perspective against another perspective. And so often there isn't the factual information to be able to point to and say, this is why this is the truth. So I found it really interesting that your book was called Chasing the Truth, because the distortion of truth is so rampant. And you would think it's an easy thing to get to, and it's the hardest thing to get to.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And we did this reporting at a time when, like, our country could not feel more polarized, right? Like, they're really, it can sometimes feel like this, like, you've got half the country over here and half the country on the other side, just like talking past each other. And you go on social media and it's full of people sharing their really strong opinions. And here was an example of a story in which there really wasn't a lot of divided opinion on this. There really was consensus that we had uncovered the truth and that something needed to be done about it. And so we really wanted to step back and show people, like, how do you produce, especially in this day of, in this age of, like, such polarization and, like, such strong opinions where the, like, definition of fact can feel like something that's slipping through your
Absolutely.
Fingers.
Absolutely.
We wanted to show how we created a piece of work that really withstood all of those forces and for which there was such consensus. People weren't debating what Harvey Weinstein did or didn't do when our story came out. They were debating what should be done in response. Mm-hmm. And that was people from all different political backgrounds. And it was, and I think that there can be, and we also make clear, we also feel like in this day in which there could be, you know, accusations of fake news and stuff like that, we really wanted to demystify this work. And we wanted to show everybody that come with us, like, we're going to pull the curtain back and show you exactly how we do this work step by step, from meeting with sources and dealing with the subjects of stories when they're coming at us with legal threats, and all of these sort of specific guidelines that we have found are really, like, help produce work that can really withstand these otherwise extremely challenging forces. that can undermine the truth.
I want to talk a little bit about how you work together, because obviously you have an extraordinary bond having worked together on this case. And I was curious how much strategy goes into when you approach a potential lead and how you know how to A, approach them. And then if you're with them and it suddenly goes sideways, how do you know what to do? It's almost like an improv class or something where you've got to think on your feet and be able to pivot and read cues from each other. How do you do it?
So in the summer, early summer of 2017, I didn't really know Megan Toohey. She was pretty new in the Times newsroom. She had been very wrapped up in Trump reporting. There's a story that's now a joke between us about she was very pregnant in the beginning of 2017, and I had left her a bag of maternity clothes on her desk, thinking that she'd want to be part of like the sisterhood of the traveling maternity pants that develops among groups of women friends at work. And she didn't take the bag. And I was like, what's up with this girl? But I knew she was an impressive reporter. But then she went off and had the baby. And she was on maternity leave when I started on the Weinstein investigation. And I really didn't know what the truth was initially. I had no connections with actresses. But very early on, there were signals that something was seriously wrong. And as you can read in Chasing the Truth, within the first, 2 months of reporting, I had spoken to Rose McGowan, Ashley Judd, and Gwyneth Paltrow, all of whom had serious, upsetting Harvey Weinstein hotel room stories that were similar. None of them were on the record, but it was a clue that something was very wrong here. So I called Megan when she was still on maternity leave for advice, because I had done a lot of reporting on gender and power in the workplace. And Megan had done a lot of reporting on sexual abuse and sexual crimes. And Rebecca Corbett, our editor, had said, call Megan. She just has a lot of experience talking to these victims. And I told her, Megan was like, I have to put the baby down for a nap. I was like, I'm familiar with that. And I said, I feel like I'm getting somewhere. I'm definitely having breaking through to some degree, but I don't feel that I have the pitch perfect yet. I want to find the exact words that will persuade someone to trust me, even somebody who's a stranger who might be a celebrity. I want to get them to somehow trust me in the first minute of a conversation. And Megan said that an argument she had used with people in the past was, I can't change what's happened to you in the past, but if we work together, we may be able to take your painful story and put it to some productive use. And as soon as she said that, I was like, that's it. That is the best argument for talking to a journalist. Mm. And it's really the only one that answers, why should I go to the trouble? I don't need the stress and all of the other natural objections that people have. So from then, I went back to my editor and I was like, when is Megan Toohey getting back from maternity leave? And luckily, it was just a couple of weeks later. And that was the beginning of this partnership that I think neither of us expected to develop, but it became exactly what you describe, Amanda. I don't think in all my work life I've ever shared a brain more fully with another person.
Your like, true work wise.
Felt more intellectually connected, and we could often achieve like the level of synchronicity that you're talking about, but also be different. There were many times when Megan noticed things that I didn't notice or vice versa, because on the one hand, you're moving as one being, but on the other hand, you're complementing one another and ideally protecting one another as well.
Jody, I was reading in the book that you showed up at someone's house. I know you relatively well. And I was just thinking, oh my God, Jody, you just randomly showed up at someone's house. That takes balls to do that. That's like some OG journalism. I was so impressed that you did that.
We both did in the course of the investigation, but my friends had the same reaction. My friends read She Said and they were like, you do that?
I know. I was like, oh my God. It was amazing.
But we did it. I think it's that interaction is a little different. If you're approaching somebody you think is a victim, that's one dynamic. If you're approaching somebody you think may have aided in the wrongdoing, that's another dynamic. We were very polite door stoppers. We would wear, like, we often wore dresses so as appear as to appear less threatening. And we would come with, like, nice notes on nice stationery, to have
strategic
something to leave for somebody in case they didn't answer the door. But I think there was actually this message of, we're not like FBI agents who are coming to, like, bust down your door. We're like, we're trying to come to you as politely as possible.
Did you ever have moments where you, either one of you, thought, oh, this is way more than we realized?
You know, the moment for me when I, like, what we were looking into and starting to uncover, like, fully crystallized was actually in one of those door knocking moments. It was in the summer. I'd been on the, I'd come back from maternity leave. I was joining Jody on the investigation. And I will confess, I've said this before, but I will confess that I came in a little, like, with a bit of skepticism. It was hard for me to imagine, as investigative reporters, you're often looking to help give voice to the voiceless, like people who are very easily overlooked or ignored or brushed aside in society. And, like, the idea that somebody like Gwyneth Paltrow was, like, a victim in need of the investigative reporting of the New York Times, that didn't quite click for me. I was like, these women are so, like, have so many resources and have such kind of a high status in society. And I wasn't quite sure if some of the stuff I had reported, pretty hardcore sex crimes in the past, and in some of the descriptions of hotel rooms where there wasn't, like, physical contact, I just wasn't that immersed in sexual harassment. So I was like, are we sure that this is worth spending all of this time on? And I didn't even know who Harvey Weinstein was, but there was this. And it was good. This was part of the partnership, right? This was part of Jody being like, no, actually, what was happening here was, like, work meetings in hotel rooms. And there was work on the line. And this is, like, straight up sexual harassment. And it's wrong. And I think we can, you know, make a difference with our reporting. And I was like, okay. So there was this moment. So speaking of door stopping, so there was this one moment. As we went on with our reporting, we realized that there was a whole nother category of victims that went beyond the stars, the actresses that there were, or just in even aspiring actresses, right? That Weinstein's playbook was to go after people often when they were, like, trying to break into the industry and starting off in their careers and, quite frankly, didn't have a lot of power or status. And we realized that he was also targeting we started to realize that there was this whole other category of victims. And those were young women who worked in his companies, you know, first Miramax and then the Weinstein Company, people who had been assistants, people who had been junior executives, people who came to work for Weinstein. He was known for being really difficult to work for in ways that went beyond the sexual harassment and the other misconduct, just like a really abusive boss. But there was this sense that if you went to work for him and you survived, it was like your gateway into the entertainment industry and you could go on. It was like could be a really valuable stepping stone. And so we started to realize that there were many women who had worked for him who had very similar stories of being, like, doing work for him in ways that turned, like, where he turned the tables and it became something much more menacing. And so there was this one day where I was going out to, we had an idea, like, there was, including this young woman who had worked in his company in the early 90s, right after college. And she disappeared. One day she just disappeared. Like, it was just her shoes that were left under her desk. And we had heard that she might have been a victim of sexual assault. And so I was trying to get in touch with her. She wasn't responding to calls. I was reaching out to her at her place of work, but I couldn't leave messages with the secretary because I didn't want to explain what the reason was and make her colleagues aware. So finally, we realized that there was a family member of hers who lived out in New York, like in a suburb of New York. And so I drove there with a card, a handwritten card, as Jody described, that I was going to leave for the family member explaining who we were and why we were working on this. And so same thing, as many of these door knocks as you do over many years as a reporter, they never get easy. You think, what would it feel like for somebody to show up on my door or to tell a family member to be coming to a family member with something like this? So I knock on the door, and the person who answers is actually the woman herself who had disappeared Weinstein's company. And she looked at me and she said, she first said, "I can't believe you found me." And she said, "I've actually been waiting for this knock on my door for 25 years. And it was this moment where I was like, holy shit. She was among the people who also was legally prohibited from speaking to us because she had been silenced through one of these secret settlements. She said, "I had a dispute." Anyway, it was this moment where I was like, oh my goodness, I think that this is so much bigger than I had initially thought. And I think it's so much darker. Like the fact that there is now, like we're now seeing not only a whole another category of victims, but to see in practice what these secret settlements have done. These things that have become the de facto way of dealing with sexual harassment and have just silenced victims and allowed predators to cover their tracks.
Continue. And so many people in my community knew what this man had done. I was friends with Rose McGowan when she was assaulted, and she told me at the time. So I knew about that.
Wow.
And I knew about multiple women. Strangely, I was in Gwyneth's car and I had plugged my iPhone into the charger. It was laying face up, and Jody called me at that time. I was in the car for 20 minutes. Goodness. And Jody's name popped up on the screen, and Gwyneth looked down and she said, "Jody Cantor?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Jody, we're friends." And she was like, "I'm thinking of going on record." And I was like, "I really encourage you." And we had a big conversation about it. And it was just so random that at that time, Jody had called me. There's people I know who still have not gone public about their experience with him, who may never speak about their experience. But certainly in my community, it was a well-known fact. What has been astounding for me is that there are so many people who co-opted his behavior and enabled his behavior. It took a system and a team of people to facilitate all of this happening, facilitate the cover-ups. Some of them you mention in your book, different lawyers that he had. But there are still people who were very aware of what they were participating in. As far as I'm concerned, they brought girls to his hotel rooms. They had those NDAs signed. What about those people? Because he didn't act alone. He was ultimately the person who was the abuser, but he had a lot of people enabling him, and there's been no reckoning for any of those people.
What we really focused on were the systems of enablement. If you look at the moral horror of the Weinstein story, it's that this man accumulated decades and decades of allegations, probably 40 years worth of allegations. And powerful people, instead of helping the victims, helped Weinstein. And that was true again and again. So why was that? And we felt like that was the question we were trying to answer. Some of it was about the power of the movies and people wanting to be in movies. But part of it was stuff that had a larger significance for everybody in the country. Like these secret settlements that Megan was just talking about, like the woman, the one signed by the woman whose door she knocked on. These are our country's routine way of dealing with sexual harassment and sometimes even sexual assault. And these agreements are still signed every single day. We wrote about Gloria Allred and Lisa Bloom, and she said in Chasing the Truth, Gloria Allred, this famous feminist lawyer who, you know, publicly talks about raising your voice and speaking out, in private, she was running a pretty lucrative business doing these agreements silencing women. She defends them as the victims.
Her daughter was consulting Harvey Weinstein on how to get out of bad PR around his behavior.
Exactly.
How you can play both sides of that, I do not know. And continue to do so.
The book has a secret memo that Lisa Bloom wrote in which she said, "I am going to deploy my feminist credentials to help you smear these women, particularly Rose McGowan." And it lays out her step-by-step method for discrediting Harvey Weinstein's accusers. So we were really focused on how can something like that happen? Because that system doesn't just pertain to women in Hollywood. And that is the part that is national, that carries over to women in every single industry. And then a lot of our focus was also on the Weinstein Company. This company, which was so prestigious in Hollywood and was churning out these Oscar-nominated films, was in fact covering up predation. And Weinstein had weaponized his own company to enable abuse. And so the question was, how does that happen at a company? And we did investigate enablement in Hollywood to a degree. The place where we really looked into it was the agencies, and particularly CIA. We were able to document the large number of times a woman had gone back to CIA agents and said, "You sent me to a hotel room to meet with Harvey Weinstein. Something really bad happened." And yet CIA kept sending these women into these hotel rooms. If these agents are protecting the women, how come there wasn't, you know, some sort of change there? I'd say our reporting was concentrated on these broad categories of people. Let's look at the board. Let's look at the lawyers by Weinstein's side. Let's look at the agencies and the role they played. I think you're right, Amanda, that doesn't mean tracking down every single person in Hollywood who played some role in one of these incidents. But I think, A, that's impossible because it's probably thousands of people, right? It's a collective failure that spreads really far. And then also, it's not always about nailing every single individual. It's about finding the systemic stuff that adds up to something larger.
It's something that I've often thought about, that there are so many people who are complicit, who are still going on to get their companies funded and are running giant corporations at this point. So still exists.
Yeah, I think that we really wanted to, as Jody said, not just look for the sort of systemic failures, but we also really wanted to. There was a lot of talk of his assistants delivered people to the...
Well, his assistants have gone on, a couple of them have gone on to be pretty powerful in their own right. Yeah. Who were his assistants at that time.
I think for us, what was really important was to look at, okay, but who really held the power at that time? Like, who really held the power and had the potential to, like, do something about this in a really meaningful way? And that wasn't the assistants. That was the board of his company. That was his brother, Bob Weinstein, who he had been in business with, like, for years. And it was one of the more, Bob ended up speaking to us at length for our book and after the initial story was published. And it was just, and some of the members of the board did too. And it was just so interesting we were really able to peel back and show how we were really able to document like what people knew and when they knew it and what they didn't do about it. And in 2015, the year that like Harvey was actually reported to the police, one of the, I think the only time that had happened by
Ambra,
the board of his company was aware of that. His brother was aware of it. They were also that same year, as we realized, aware of a complaint by one of the junior executives in the company who like wrote a scathing long document to HR, like listing all of the rampant harassment that the boss was doing. The board knew about that memo too, and they chose to base it. And that year, they re-upped his contract.
I want to talk about the day that the story broke because I will never forget that day. I remember Jody texting me and saying, "Okay, this story is going live at 10:15 PST," and I was weirdly being interviewed on E! News that day for a project I was doing. By the time I had done the interview, the story had been published. I had got downstairs. It was crazy seeing how fast and furious this story went. And I'm wondering how you felt finally having this body of work that you had both spent years on out in the world. How did you both feel?
On the one hand, it was incredibly gratifying because life had become binary at that point. I think for months, we had just felt like we're going to get the story or we're not. Or are we going to succeed or are we going to fail? And that just became like my dominant sort of obsession, all waking moments. And so knowing that, like the comfort of knowing that it was finally in print and it was finally in public was a relief, but it's easy in retrospect to look back on how the sort of globalization of Me Too went and the giant wave that ensued and think, oh, of course these women were treated as heroes and of course this became such a powerful thing. But we did not know that at the time, Amanda. We were very worried about our sources. The original Weinstein story had two women who gave interviews on the record, Laura Madden, a former assistant who lived in Wales, and Ashley Judd. And Gwyneth was waiting in the wings,
yes,
was ready to go on record for a second story. And we had other forms of evidence. We had 25 years worth of evidence in the form of company notes and these memos and the settlements and the legal and financial trail and quotes from other employees and da, da, da. But we thought Ashley Judd was putting her career on the line. We thought she might be ruined. We didn't know what kind of retaliation Weinstein was capable of. We did not know about the Black Cube stuff at the time, but we were pretty sure he was up to no good. And so it was not like a spiking the football in the end zone moment, because there's always, and we write in the book about Megan took some of the women on the record about Trump and had to face the fact that these women did not have easy experiences coming forward. And as a reporter, you have to take responsibility for the fact of what if I've convinced this woman to tell her story publicly, and what if it doesn't go well? And so we were just braced. We were braced. We did not know what the world's response would be. And Ashley Judd, God bless her, I don't know how she did this, but she decided that she didn't want to live on Twitter for the reaction. So she took off camping in the forest.
Oh,
she was,
yeah.
Like, in
amazing
the Great Smoky Mountains.
She knows. She was barely, she's a pro.
There was some early positive reaction, and I would try to send her one or two things to see. She'd be like, no. And she would text back a photo of a, I don't know, magnolia tree or something.
She knows. She's smart. She knows that you cannot be paying attention because it becomes all too consuming. That's one of the things that I always say to people is when they have a big thing come out in the media, it's just step back from it. You'll hear if there's anything you really need to know, someone will tell you. But being glued to it can be really detrimental for your mental health. So one of the two cases that actually ended in conviction was the one was Weinstein. The other one was Bill Cosby, who I don't know how is out and free. But Weinstein is the only other person who has actually been convicted of a sex crime felony. And that was in February 2020. And I know you, Jody, attended the hearing. Megan, did you go as well?
Yeah, we were there. It was actually the very last thing that we did before lockdown, the pandemic lockdown in 2020, was to attend his sentencing. Mm.
Can you describe that day in court? And did you ever make eye contact with him?
Mm. I'm trying to remember if we made eye contact with him. What I can tell you is that it was, you're right, it was actually, there were lines to get into the courtroom, and Jody and I actually weren't sure if we were going to make it in. And we actually only made it in the end because so few people had showed up for the area reserved for Weinstein's people. So it's interesting, this person who really seemed to have so much kind of control and influence for so many years was really there in the courtroom virtually by himself. And whereas for the women who had the victims in the case, who had been who had so bravely testified, were there with tons of support.
Yes.
And to just watch how they broke down crying when they heard the sentencing, which was, I'm trying to remember, it was 23 years in prison for so long. Listen, it was we also weren't sure what was going to happen with that case. First of all, so our story breaks, Ronan's story breaks, the dam breaks, and dozens and dozens of women come forward with their stories about him. And yet for months and months, there was no indication that there was necessarily going to be a criminal prosecution. So many of the allegations against him were of sexual harassment, which is a civil offense. You're not going to end up in criminal court for sexual harassment. A lot of the allegations of crimes, of sex crimes, were too old to be prosecuted or outside of the jurisdiction of New York. There were investigations in New York, in LA, in London, And we were watching month after month and wondering, is the sort of accountability that's taken place in the court of public opinion going to ever
translate
in an actual courtroom? Mm. And so even when the charges were brought here in New York, we came to realize that it was a really, in some ways, risky case, that oftentimes prosecutors don't bring rape charges or sexual assault charges if the victim has engaged, has had friendly contact with the
part of our broken system.
Yeah. And this was, we realized, and this was a case where all of the women had continued to have, this was part of how Harvey worked, right? Like, people still had to maintain good relationships with him in order to like work in the same industry. And so, of course, he and his lawyers pulled out that defense and said that it was actually the women taking advantage of him. And he had this female attorney, Donna Rotuno, who
that was a
had made a
move.
Career out of representing men. And she really worked hard to present this as a case that like showed that the whole Me Too movement had gone too far. So
didn't one of you speak to her actually?
I did, yeah. I interviewed her on The Daily, which was one of the more memorable interviews. It was almost at the very end when I asked her if she had ever been a victim of sexual assault. And she said, no, because I would never put myself in that position.
That tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, and it was really telling. It was a really telling comment. And she really was articulating so much of the kind of Me Too backlash, and men are being unfairly prosecuted and women bear responsibility for what happens to them if they choose to go to the hotel rooms, then basically like they should be prepared to
be assaulted.
But this is a long way of saying that Jody and I really appreciated the stakes felt so high in this case because it really was pushing the envelope in sex crimes prosecutions, and also because his defense had gone to such great lengths to make it seem, we knew that the Me Too movement wasn't on trial, but they had really, it was hard to separate. I feel like it sometimes was. Yeah. So anyway, when the judge ruled guilty, it was on multiple charges. We recognized that this story that had started with journalism had now really, it was remarkable to watch it actually take hold in the criminal justice system.
That was the best case scenario you could have had. So we're 4 years later now since you broke this story. Have we made the progress that you had hoped for? And Jody, you and I have spoken about this multiple times. We've had more headlines, more awareness than historically ever before. But do you think we've actually made progress to ultimately prevent sexual assault and sexual abuse happening across the board? Because from where I stand, I almost feel like we're in a holding pattern and that actually we haven't made that much progress since this phenomenal awareness. That's at least my feeling. So I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Everything's changed and nothing's changed. But that's also what it means to live in a time of social change. Yes, there's been progress. Some laws have changed. Harvey Weinstein was convicted. R. Kelly was finally brought to justice and convicted. And yeah, the headlines do not stop. I remember in late 2017, people were saying, oh, give me a couple of weeks. It's all going to die down. It's never died down. We're talking to you from New York, where the governor just lost his job because of allegations of sexual harassment that dated from peak Me Too. Some of those allegations I chronicled for the paper, they were like in the fall of 2017 as all this stuff was breaking. Our own governor,
you would think this guy got the memo,
was allegedly targeting women. Exactly. So, you know, it never stops. And it's also extraordinary, Amanda, that during almost 2 years of separation and lockdown and no offices and very few parties, it never stopped even then. Even during this period where you're literally not allowed to touch other people and everybody's separated by 6 feet, the Me Too headlines would still keep dominating. But look, we also hear what you're saying about this feeling that there's been a lack of progress. And where you see that most readily is in low-income jobs. Look, if we're talking about a fancy Wall Street investment bank, if we're talking about the top, really elite Hollywood agencies, this stuff is now verboten there. It's not perfect. It's not that the problem's been entirely fixed, but there are heavy penalties. It's a major reputational risk at this point.
It is.
In and mainstream elite circles. But where we worry the most is that for a woman who's serving burgers at McDonald's, whose boss keeps pawing at her and he won't stop, the question of whether that woman has any recourse or really protection is just completely unanswered.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about how it has changed in the more elite industries. And there's also been a terrible backlash in elite industries. Unfortunately, the pendulum needs to swing extremely in one direction to come back and find some kind of middle ground. But one of the fallouts has been that I don't know a man who will mentor a woman now or be in a room by themselves with a woman. It's got quite extreme at times, which is disappointing to hear as well, because I think there's a lot of missed opportunity in that.
But just to argue with you for a sec, I'm not sure if that's backlash or inappropriate overcorrection. Those men, it's not backlash in the sense that they're saying, I'm a man's man and I'm going to have my way with the younger women in the office in any way I want. That's not what they're saying. They're saying they're scared and they're saying that they're overcorrecting and maybe even overcorrecting in a way that hurts women, which is not good. But I think the fact that it's an overcorrection is telling. And that's what I mean about this is what it's like to work, to live through social change. People are going to, it's really messy, right? It's really messy. People are going to overreact. They're going to freak out. They're going to do it wrong. Because the old rules on sex and power have been swept away.
And we don't have new rules yet. That's the thing. That's when I was saying, have we made progress and we're somewhat in a holding pattern, is because I don't think people understand what all of the new rules are. And some of them are common sense, right? Some of them we're pretty clear about. But the full range of what is acceptable, people aren't really aware. That leaves so much space for something like cancel culture, which is more active than the law in many cases. So I'm actually curious what your thoughts are on cancel culture and how the court of public opinion is making decisions about who's guilty and who isn't.
Listen, I think that this is another reason where there's no question that we are not in charge of the HR policies in companies, and we obviously can't control the cancel culture that so many people complain about. But what we can do is we can, it's another reason that we wanted to show how it is that we do what we do. Like, it's, we can't, once again, we're not the systems of criminal justice. We can't control what happens in workplaces. But we can show you the very specific guidelines that we follow to gather the truth and publish it. That's, there can be this misconception that somebody comes to us with a story, an allegation, and we turn around and put it in the newspaper without understanding that there's so much work that happens behind the scenes in terms of verifying. Okay, Gwyneth Paltrow, for example, you're telling us that at the time that you had this really troubling encounter with Harvey Weinstein, you were dating Brad Pitt at the time, and you went home and told him, and then Brad Pitt said something to Weinstein like, we're going to have to talk to Brad Pitt to verify that. But there's this whole, when it comes to that, we are not just gathering accounts and working to get people on the record, but we were also extracting internal company records and a whole body of evidence that was ultimately at the foundation of our story, so that when it came out, that nobody could say, oh, these are two opinionated reporters looking to cancel Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
There was no, how do you basically do work and hold people to account in ways that don't, with integrity?
Well, that's the opposite of cancel culture.
And I think that's what we're trying to show.
What you did was the opposite of cancel culture. And what I loved about this book is that it is somewhat of a guidebook. You could take the principles and apply it to so many different things. So I love that you laid it all out. Again, I just want to come back and say, what are your thoughts on cancel culture and the impact that has had on some of the stories that we've heard? Because the court of public opinion is incredibly powerful. And me personally, I feel like there's a lack of accountability and a lack of process. And yet, there is still huge impact from journalists who are writing stories where they aren't as thorough with their research and they aren't investigating to the thorough degree which perhaps you both are with your work. And I know multiple of those cases. So I do want to just hear both of your opinions on cancel culture because it is very omnipresent.
I just totally agree with Megan that what we do is meant to be a kind of alternative to cancel culture, like a contrast with it. Like careful investigative journalism should feel very different than cancel culture. It should feel based on facts. It should feel impartial. It's about saying, you can't solve a problem you can't see. So let's get the facts on the table. Let's get a real assessment of what women in this country and others have faced in the workplace in terms of sexual harassment, because the truth is that nobody knew. We did not have a complete picture. And once you assess that complete picture, then you can have a productive social discussion about how we should deal with it.
Mm-hmm. We're in the middle of another big case right now with Ghislaine Maxwell. I'm wondering what the outcome of that case is going to be, because given the evidence against her participation and how many people have spoken up, I'm wondering if either one of you have thoughts on how that case could go.
Listen, I think that case, Jody and I were both part of, we both did reporting on Epstein. And I think that what was interesting when, obviously, Julie Brown in Florida was the one who really brought that case and what pulled the evidence against him back into the light in her incredible reporting at the Miami Herald. And the fact that it just felt like another example where so many people were aware of Epstein's wrongdoing. In fact, the police and prosecutors had even done a very weak case against him years before. And it really took a journalist, like a determined journalist, to come into the picture and to really reveal not just so many of the allegations against him, but how nobody had stopped him. And so to watch that when the charges were brought against him here in New York, a lot of us, you know, reporters here in New York jumped on the story. And I think it was one of the first things that Jody and I did when we came back from writing, she said. So it was just really interesting to see the parallels in the case and to see how it was once again another, this wasn't just a story of an individual predator. It was really like an X-ray into power and how these powerful people end up having like orbits of kind of complicity. And the fact that there was a woman who had even apparently been a girlfriend for a long time, who then transitioned into this role as an alleged.
Even with girls I know that have been trafficked, they have often told me that it was a woman who solicited them initially. Yeah. It's a strategic move on the part of the guy to do that because right. A woman may seem more friendly and safe.
Exactly. So I think that's what's so interesting. That's what's really interesting about this case against her is it's really shining a light directly on the role that women can play in being complicit. And I'm not, we'll see what happens sure. In the case. So she hasn't been convicted, but even just the facts that have emerged in the case in terms of at least the allegations as they, in terms of her, like not just seeking out young women that she thought
that
would
she
be.
Participated in assault.
And that she groomed. Yes. And that she groomed, that there was a grooming process there and that she participated. And so with Weinstein, we saw some of these sort of surprising female figures like the Lisa Blooms, the lawyers who helped, who were by him side and helping him in a legal way or in an effort to smear accusers. But obviously this takes us into just a whole nother realm of complicity in which it actually amounts to grooming. And I think it'll be, it's hard to predict what's going to happen in that case, but I think that it is shining light on a really important issue and one that should not escape our attention as we grapple with all of the layers of complicity that are at the heart of so many of these Me Too stories. Mm-hmm.
So the last thing I want to ask you is, has the work that both of you do around sexual assault and sexual violence affected how you view parenting? Jody, I know that you're the mother of a teen daughter. I know for me, it's the awareness I have of how, why, when sexual assault can possibly occur has made me an extra protective parent. And I'm wondering if it's affected you at all, because I really struggle with this one.
Absolutely. I mean, so Megan and I have three daughters between us. My younger one was a year and a half when the story was published. And then my older daughter is a teenager now, but
it's fine.
She was going through puberty.
Yeah, you dedicate the book to them, I think.
Investigation. She was 11. And
no, that's fine.
I was watching her edge towards this world of adulthood as we were investigating. And one of the patterns in this work is that there is a real new girl on the job pattern to these stories, whether with Weinstein or other alleged perpetrators. There's this type, this girl who shows up at work, who's ambitious and smart and wants a piece of the action. Who knows what background she's from? Who knows what industry she's from? But she's newly arrived in the workforce and she wants to initiate. She wants to prove herself. She wants to work hard and use her brains and have a career. And part of what's heartbreaking is you see how that can be deployed against her. That's what Weinstein did. He took women's ambitions and he turned them against them. And so I'm, you know, left with a feeling not only about our own daughters, but just women generally. And these girls who are going into the workplace for the first time need to be protected.
Yeah, listen, this is part of like when you try to assess the impact of the Me Too movement, right? Like it's, okay, what's happening in the criminal courts? What's happening in HR departments? But also what's happening in homes, right? It's these private moments. It's friends and families having these conversations and trying to unpack this stuff in ways that can be just as significant, honestly. And my daughter was very young when, obviously, I started this story my first day back from maternity leave. And she wasn't even 1 year old. But I remember as we continued this reporting and she got a little older, I even had these moments where I thought, oh my gosh, I've done reporting on sex crimes for years. I've thought a lot about this. And yet there are things that I felt like I was just, where I just also found myself asleep at the wheel. There was a moment I remember it with my daughter where I realized, and this is so common, and I don't think it's just with little girls. I think it can also happen with little boys, but I think maybe it especially happens with little girls, like this pressure to go give so-and-so a hug, go and give so-and-so a kiss, go and I like had this moment where I was like, oh my God, you know, and I, even at such a young age, I sat her down and was like, kissing somebody, hugging somebody is your choice. Don't ever let anybody tell you what to do. What does it look like to help foster a culture of true consent? How do we do that as parents with our children?
For me, it's an ongoing conversation.
But Amanda, Megan and I are not educators. We're not politicians. We can't pass laws. We're not activists, but we are writers. And part of the excitement we feel about this particular book is that Chasing the Truth is a book for young people. It's She Said is sort of the adult version, and Chasing the Truth is the one that is intended for your daughter.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal read, and it's an incredible tool. And I just want to thank you so much for writing it, because I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope it is insightful and supportive and encouraging for as many, you know, people as possible.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for the great conversation.
I always love hearing what you have to say, Jody. And Megan, it's such a pleasure to finally meet you. So thank you for joining. Thank you so much. Okay. Bye, Megan.
Bye.
Talk to you soon, Jody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the conversation, please support the podcast by commenting, liking, and subscribing to wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And you can follow me on social media at Amanda DeCadney on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you want more of the conversation content and you want to delve just a little bit deeper into many of the subjects that we talk about on here, then I invite you to join myself and many other like-minded women in the newly launched The Conversation Community. This is a private and safe space to have the hard conversations that make life just a little bit easier. You can join up at amandadecadney.com, and I'll see you there.